You're listening to Non Sequitur, The Audacity of Reason, Season 1, Episode 12. Irreverent, a spirited message of less dogma and more sex. Featuring special guest, Reverend Stephanie Clark. Each week, Non Sequitur goes live, bringing you the most interesting and controversial discussions held between the leading voices on a variety of issues. To make sure you never miss a show, please visit www.youtube.com/nonsequiturshow and subscribe now. For upcoming shows, past episodes, and ways to support the show, please visit www.nonsexshow.com. That's NONSEQ show.com. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
And joining us now is the irreverent reverend herself, Stephanie Clark. Stephanie, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for inviting me on the show.
We're so glad that you're here. For someone that may not be familiar with you, can you kind of give us a synopsis of who you are, what you do, and what makes you different?
Okay. Well, you can probably hear I was born in Britain. Didn't really have a religious upbringing at all, which I'm most grateful for because it means I have less baggage to work through. And I had spiritual leanings that I didn't really understand for the longest time. And then I ended up emigrating to South Africa, where I discovered the first Church of Religious Science. And for most people who are listening, if they know the name Louise Hay, she was one of the early proponents of the science of mind. And she was able to speak about the teaching in a way that made it human and easy to apply in a person's life. I came across her work, and it turned out that when I discovered the first Church of Religious Science in Johannesburg, that this was Louise Hay's teaching. And most people think Louise Hay created that teaching herself, but she didn't. It's called Science of Mind. So I started studying spiritual growth, and that's what I knew I had been looking for all along. And the religions that I'd come across in my earlier life had not spoken to what it was that I was looking for at all. But Science of Mind did. And for me, the difference between, should I go into that now? The difference between traditional religion and Science of Mind or spiritual?
Sure. I think that's a good, because I was sitting here, you know, as someone who, I grew up Southern Baptist in the Bible Belt of the States. And I'm used to the concept of you have to keep a ruler in between you and if you're dancing with somebody, if you're even allowed to dance at all. You know, some Baptist churches, you're not even allowed to dance with anyone of the opposite sex
you have until you're married to the Holy Ghost.
Right. So let's pretend like we're looking at this from somebody in that perspective. Like, this is because I've read up on it, but this is a completely, I think, departure from what people think religion is. And I think that it's important for people to see that there are alternatives out there and some that you might not ever knew existed. So kind of contrast the two and what makes them so starkly different.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'd say the big difference for me is that in traditional religion, there's a sense that there's a big God, usually a daddy God up there somewhere in the sky, who's supposed to be a god of love, but actually quite a punishing, violent figure and quite warlike. And we as humans are peons. We're worms in the dust. We are powerless victims. And we have to pray to and appease this god if we're going to have anything in our life that's worth living for.
Well said. that sums it up.
So then for me, the spiritual teaching that I'm a part of, The basic idea is that there's only one power, so it's not a male anthropomorphic god. It's a power. It's not a human, and we are one with that. So one god, and we are its emanations or its. I don't like the word children because again, there's a bit of a status going on there, a difference in a bigger god and a smaller human. So we're emanations. It's like the drops of water in the ocean. We have all the same qualities. So created in the image and likeness of the divine means that I am a divine being. And that just as much as the creative power of the universe created everything, I also create. So I'm made in the image and likeness. I am made creative. So my creative power is in my thought and my words, my thinking and my speaking. So as I think along the lines of truth, okay, let me define truth. So if I think along the lines of there's only one power and I am that, and that power is good, it's a power for good, it's a power of love. If my thinking is based on love, my life is amazing. When mm-hmm. I think in terms of separation, like I'm separate from God, I'm separate from love, I'm separate from money, or I'm separate from health, or I'm separate from satisfaction and fulfillment, then my life is not amazing. My life reflects those negative thoughts and beliefs. And the whole point of the science of mind teaching is to really work with that notion that it's done unto you as you believe. Jesus said, it's done unto you as you believe. And the way Christians typically interpret that is, if I believe in Jesus Christ, that he came to earth to save me for my sins, I will be saved. That's the kind of Christian, that's my understanding of how Christians see things. So the way that we interpret that in science of mind is, it's done unto you as you believe, meaning that whatever you believe to be true about yourself, about life, about other people, about the world, that will show up in your experience on earth. So if I believe that I'm totally loved everywhere I go, that will be my experience. If I believe that no matter how hard I try, money always slips through my fingers, that will be my experience. So the whole purpose of the teaching is to work with our thought life and become more and more loving, kind, expanded, and thinking along the lines of possibility. And what can I give to this life? How can I contribute? How can I serve? Where can I express my gifts and talents and abilities? How can I make the world a better place? By being true to who I am as a divine being.
I think this entire, I guess, category of religion just really fascinates me, I think, because to me it's interesting to see how different people think about the afterlife and if there's a higher power. My question is, do you guys have a central, I guess, do you have a central deity that you look to, I guess would be the best way to put it? Or is it kind of like we are all collective, as like you were saying, the drops in the water. Is that kind of the way that it goes? Or do you actually have a central like hierarchy of deities, I guess?
I know that's confusing.
Yeah.
Is there a monotheism component, or is it more like a panpsychism?
Definitely monotheistic, but not in the same way that a Christian Christianity or Islam or Judaism would be monotheistic, because it's, again, it's a power, not a person. It's a power. So we don't worship in the sense of the way Christians worship God. We don't worship this one power. But we do acknowledge that it's hard to describe, isn't it? It's always finding language is always the tricky thing. But
I understand.
The more I grow, the more I research, the more I learn, the more I'm moving away from the concept of an outer God or a higher God or some power that's an authority over my life. So, but I do still believe that there is a power other than me. I am not the God of the universe. I'm God in the flesh, but I'm not the God of the universe. So there's a power that's bigger than me that Stephanie cannot heal a cut. Stephanie cannot mend a bone. You know that I don't have that power. There's a power flowing through me that's bigger than me that can create, that can heal, that can restore balance and order. So do we worship him? I think that the more that you and I grow spiritually, the more aligned we become with who we essentially are as divine beings, the less outer gods we worship. So like I no longer worship the God of money. I no longer worship the God of sex. I no longer worship the God of alcohol. So I'm withdrawing power that I've given to outer forces and becoming less of a victim to powers that I perceive to be outside of myself.
You kind of place where you may not have a name for it or a title, you place kind of a center there that you kind of pull from, and you pulling from that center allows you to kind of pass off the, I guess what you would call the bad traits or the things that you used to be beholden unto, in order to make yourself more on the level of that thing in which you were originally drawing from. So it's almost like you're taking back the control that you once saw in something else. Is that kind of
Yeah, I think that's good. Yep, that sums it up.
But you're not anthropomorphizing any of these things, right? I mean, the god of the money is just a way of expressing the you giving, he said, as Kyle put it, giving something to them, to it. It's a control factor. Instead of letting them control your life, you're saying that you're just calling it a god of money, although that's not what you would find in most like deifications. It's not a deity per se. It's just that you are giving it control. Therefore, you're treating it as a higher type entity, but not really a being of any kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. Very articulate. Thank you.
What is the? Can you give us kind of a brief history of where this kind of stemmed from? You kind of went over how you found it, but take us back farther. Where did this originally kind of begin? If you know, or is it just kind of something that materialized recently? Like, was it just a collective group of people that said, you know, we feel the same way about, you know, X, Y, and Z? Or does this stem backwards, you know, Christianity or your standard run of the mill religions would go?
No, I can answer it. So the founder of the teaching, The Science of Mind, his name was Ernest Holmes, and he grew up in the late 1800s on the East Coast of America, and he came from a very strict Christian household. And he, as he grew older, read very widely. He read philosophy, religion, the world's religions, and he began to notice the salient truth that ran through all major world religions. And he realized from his reading in philosophy as well that the human mind is creative. So he put together the teaching called The Science of Mind, but he had also great teachers. He learned from Mary Baker Eddy, who was the founder of Christian Science, and her star student was Emma Curtis Hopkins. So Emma Curtis Hopkins was a mystic of note, and she taught Ernest Holmes. And there were other teachers too that arose at this time. You've probably heard of the Unity Church. Mm-hmm. Charles and Myrtle Fillmore started the Unity Church. So Emma Curtis Hopkins taught Ernest Holmes, Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, and then I think it was Nona Cox who started Divine Science. So towards the end of the 1800s, these, they're called New Thought teachings, were emerging. And at the time in America, it was the time of hellfire and brimstone. So the people who were practicing the New Thought teachings were really at risk. They were thought to be occultists, and they could have actually been thrown into jail for practicing what they understood to be the truth. So
some places would still probably do that today.
Yeah. Right. You're right. So Ernest Holmes, he did a lot of exploration in the realm of psychism, and but didn't dare to speak about it publicly because he would have been jailed for it. And as time went on, the teachings became more widely acceptable. And Ernest Holmes never wanted this teaching to be a religion. He said everyone could benefit from learning how to use their minds properly. And he gave lectures in LA and taught to huge groups of people. And he said, you can be a better Jew if you use this teaching. You can be a better Catholic if you use this teaching. You can be a better Christian. It's all about learning to control your mind. And it doesn't really have anything to do with a religion as such. The people around him wanted to organize as a religion. And so I think it was 1926 or 27. They formed a church called the Church of Religious Science. So nearly 100 years ago, that's when it became officially recognized as a religion.
Like I was kind of joking, but kind of not. It seems like there are still places that exist today that would definitely penalize you or make you, if at least, feel like some sort of an outcast in society for having sort of a off-brand religion. But why do you think it is that for some people, it makes sense that you could have a talking snake in a garden, talking people into eating apples for, like you said, the Sky Man. Why is that considered normal, or that's okay, but kind of embracing the enlightenment of who you are and trying to make yourself centered and be a better person, why is that scoffed at? It seems like in a rational, logical world, the two would be switched. But why do you think it is that brand is deemed normal and anything outside of that is just can't have it?
That's a lovely question. Okay, so I think that we are evolving, and there's a part of our brain, the mammalian or reptilian part, reptilian and mammalian part of our brains, that are really stuck in survival. And when I say stuck in survival, I mean stuck in the comfort zone, stuck in what we know, whether it's true or not.
Right.
Doesn't make any difference.
Just, this obviously. Familiar.
This must be true. I'm going to stick with this. And so at this stage in our evolutionary journey as human beings, we've had 2,000 years of Christianity and more years of Judaism. Mm-hmm. And so we've got this history that, because it's, again, because it's, it feels like it's part of us. And then how can we not believe that stuff? It's too much of a transition for most people to even think that there's a possibility that that is not the truth, because it's so much a part of who we are, based on our training and our conditioning, what our forefathers, and even me, like I wasn't even born into a very religious household, but I was born in a Northern European Christian culture. I was born in England. So when I started to really examine feminist spirituality, the author of the book that I was reading, her name's Patricia Lynn Riley, she said, imagine a female God. And I freaked out, like, that's so sick. That's blasphemy. That's sinful. And I was already a feminist. I was already open to new thought. I was already training to be a new thought minister. But when someone suggested, imagine a female God, I was so frightened.
Really?
What I was frightened of? I was frightened of being excommunicated as a heretic, because what if I imagined this female God and I started to really believe that this might be something that was true? And what if I was wrong and the big male daddy God zapped me for it?
and there is where I think the ultimate genius in wherever it ultimately stemmed from, you know, kind of sunk the claws in, so to speak. Like, it, if you are a true believing religious person, the sad thing is that your brain naturally wants to wonder and think, why is it this way? Why does this work this way? But they have planted this switch, this failsafe that will catch you from trying to wander off too far. So that, and I've been there. I mean, I grew up Southern Baptist, hellfire and brimstone. Anytime you have thoughts that deviated from that path, you then have to stop and go, wait a minute, I'm being unfaithful. This is exactly what they warned me about what happened. And it's a shame to see that your brain is fighting against everything to wake you up and show you that, look, you need to ask questions. You need to, you know, this is not the way that it's supposed to be. But that indoctrination keeps you padlocked to it. And I think that society could just be, I often think all the time how wonderful society could be if that veil was lifted a lot sooner. And maybe you can answer this. I think that you've probably seen an increase in the interest in, especially the kind of alternative spirituality. Have you noticed that? Like, people seem to be finally breaking loose of that and going to, you know, kind of alternative methods. Is that a true statement?
That's definitely my observation too. And when I first came back from America to South Africa to start my church, I met a lot of people who said, oh, wow, I was already thinking this way. And now I discover there's a church where they teach that stuff. That, like, people didn't realize that there was a church that espoused those principles. And I think what happens, if there is an intention to know the truth or to grow spiritually or to be free – that intention based on the laws of mind that I teach. So there's just that intention to be free and to know the truth gathers the books, the people, the teachers, the movies, whatever is required for that truth to be taught or understood. So I know that I always had a strong yearning for freedom, and the way it expressed as a younger person, and still today to a certain extent, was I was just a rebel. You know, I was just discounting everything that I was presented with. But that yearning for freedom brought me to South Africa, I believe, and brought me into contact with my spiritual teacher at the church, and brought me into contact with more spiritual teachers in LA. So that yearning is what got me out of the old stultified ways of thinking. And I believe that's true for everybody. So, and that spirit of freedom, I believe, is implanted within us. That's part of our divine nature, that we really yearn to be free. And sometimes that freedom might look like in South Africa, the freedom looked like freedom from apartheid. But there's a real deeper yearning, as far as I'm concerned, is freedom from the constraints of the mind, freedom from that old reptilian way of thinking, the fight or flight mechanism, freedom from the indoctrination that says you can't, or you're bad, or if you dare to step out, you're going to get zapped. You know, all of that. That's our freedom.
Christopher Hitchens, I think, said it best when he summed it up by saying that traditional religion, you're born sick and commanded to be well. And that is just an ultimate, you can't overcome that. You know, when you're told that you were born into a broken way, and then instructed that you have to now fix yourself, I think it just puts people on an unattainable path. Steve, I know you probably have a question about
that. Yeah, I do have a few things.
Yeah,
it definitely is an indoctrination technique. And of course, I'm not an anti-theist. I'm not against religion at all. I'm not even an atheist, but I do see that there are times where people have used these things as a means to keep people in certain faiths. And that fear factor that people have, as you mentioned, the fight or flight, the predatory prey thing that we've all been exposed to, that reptilian part of our brain that says, hey, you know, we need to be afraid of this because it's detrimental to our health or to our lives. And that fear of the unknown is one of the biggest factors that we have. Matter of fact, when we're born, we're only born with a couple of fears, and one of which is things that are loud noises. That's a thing where babies will jerk, and they'll know something. There's a fear factor. So we have still things for fear. We want to be saved. We want to be able to procreate. But let me ask you, when it comes to like Holmes, he did a lot when it came to like reading philosophy, right? I mean, he studied the teachings of Jesus and Buddha. He read a lot of the Bible and stuff. So did he think these people were just not of divine origin, but they were just some sort of just wise men, and they took a lot of those teachings and put it all together? Because it does sound a lot like psychism, or at least panpsychism, where there's this universal consciousness and that you're a part of that universal consciousness, whether there's a breakdown where there's this, normally with psychism, you have like this, they call it a fluid of some kind, like a soul that's embodied in everything. So everything has a mind. But panpsychism is more that you are a part of this universal consciousness. But does that universal consciousness that you're speaking of, is it an aware entity? Is it something that actually created the universe consciously? Or is it something that manifested out of it? For example, like in the Norse tradition, chaos isn't really a actual god per se, depends on who you ask, but it's the universe came out of chaos. And so is this a natural extension for the fact that we had a chaos at the initial part of the universe, like for example, quantum fluctuations? Do you think that the universe was created by this actual being, or is just a manifestation that resulted from some kind of force? That kind of makes sense, a long-winded way of saying, you know, how do you believe the universe was created?
Well, one of the terms we use is consciousness. So what came first, the chicken or the egg? Consciousness.
So there was a universal consciousness. But not like ever heard of a Boltzmann brain?
Sorry,
It's called a Boltzmann brain. A Boltzmann brain is a hypothetical brain that can exist in the universe, but it only exists for like a microsecond. But in that time, the universe actually becomes conscious.
Oh, I had never heard that.
Wow.
Yeah. it's a real thing that theoretical thing, but so
that's out there.
Well, a lot of religious teachings are even quantum mechanics, a lot of crazy stuff. But yeah, the reason I'm wondering is because, like I said, you know, I know Holmes, you know, used a lot of things that he read in the building of this the science of religion or religion of well, I'm sorry, what is it?
Religious science,
the science of mind. Yeah, religious science. So. Did he feel that they were just like very wise men? I mean, what was his actual belief when it came to like Jesus? The Islam religions would say he was a prophet. What would you think Ernest Holmes would have said?
He would have said that he was a highly evolved being who was in touch with his divine origins, probably more than most people who were around at the time. A teacher and. But not the exception. So in Christianity, Jesus is the exception, and we have to be perfect like him in order to hope for salvation. But Ernest Holmes would say that, no, he's not the exception. And he even said, these and greater things shall ye do. In other words, we can surpass Jesus with our capacity to create miracles, that kind of thing. So we are the same. Jesus was just more aware of his divine origins than most people are, even today, 2,000 years later.
So he was in tune with it, but did he believe the same things that like, you would have believed now? Did he believe that he was just part of this universal consciousness, or did he actually believe that he was literally the son of this anthropomorphic God, according to what Holmes would have said?
Oh, I see. No, I think, I think he would have believed, that he was one with the whole, like part of the universal consciousness and the teachings, I think, about the... You know how in the Bible they talk about the relationship with the Father. So that was just, a way to explain to the people about the close connection between themselves and this universal consciousness. But they used human analogies to try and express what that relationship was like. But if you have a father who's an autocrat or punishing or drunk or violent, you know, it's not a great way to start to imagine your relationship with the divine. But anyway, that's how it was then, and that's the best they could do.
When researching this, I mentioned it before we started the call, but the first image I have of you is when you're at this conference and you get up and you're doing a speech for women, and you have on this very, very Sunday-looking robe. And you go into your presentation and you have a very captivating, I think, way of delivering your message. So I kind of want to go into that now. And when looking through the stuff online and reading, I came across a kind of like, it's almost like a bio of you, but it has questions at the bottom. And I've, over the past couple of weeks, looked, and I really can't think of a better way to ask these questions than how they are, because I think that they're familiar enough for people who are, you know, familiar with standard religions to kind of grasp. But I think that the answers are going to be fascinating. So I'd like to ask you a couple, if you don't mind. How has our biblical heritage impacted our relationship to our bodies, our sexuality, and the opposite sex? Because this is kind of your specialty, right? The sexuality behind kind of spirituality. So let's dive right into that.
Okay. So I believe that the whole Adam and Eve story was a wonderful patriarchal myth, that it was a tool of political control. And before Genesis, the matriarchal religions were the power. The people worshipped the goddess, and they before people knew that men impregnated women, they saw that women gave birth, and they assumed that women must have given birth to the planet. There must be a great mother that has given birth to the earth. They saw that women bled and didn't die. So they understood that the blood must be a mystical thing, that women can bleed and not die. That's an amazing thing. Women were revered. And then along came the Jews and were trying to oust the feminine or the goddess-based religions. They were trying to enforce their belief in Yahweh. And all of the ways that women were once worshipped, that was then turned around. So in the story of Adam and Eve, there are similarities with how it was in the goddess, in the times when the goddess was worshipped. So the goddess always had a temple, and the priestesses were the female servants of the goddess. And so in the Adam and Eve story, Eve is a priestess. And the priestesses used to have snakes in the temple. They always had a snake pit, and they believed the snakes were the bearers of wisdom. And they also saw the snakes as the symbols of eternal life, because they could shed their skin and not die. And the priestesses were often seers and prophetesses. So they would listen to the wisdom of the snakes and then give prophecy. So here that we have in the Genesis version of that we see Eve listening to the snake and being told bad things, whereas when the priestess was listening to the wisdom of the snake in the goddess's temple, she would have been told things that were helpful or healing to the people that were asking for her prophecy.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. It is, isn't it, how it got just twisted around?
Yeah.
And something that always fascinated me was how come Adam and Eve covered themselves up with fig leaves and yet they ate from the apple tree? Like, where did the fig leaves suddenly come in? Where were the fig trees all this time? And then I learned that in the goddess's temple, they had sycamore fig trees, and the people used to eat the figs in the goddess's temple. And for them, it represented the flesh and the fluid of the goddess. Isn't that beautiful?
Is this similar to the narrative of like Lilith and the priestesses of Ishtar?
I was going to ask that. Okay. You hear Lilith a lot now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's coming back into the sphere of our attention. I love it. So Lilith was considered to be Adam's first wife. And I'm still not sure. I'm still researching it. I'm still not sure if she was entirely... Well, I believe the whole Adam and Eve story was myth anyway. So I'm not quite sure when the sources were of the Lilith story. I know that in the medieval times, that's when Lilith became really quite a prominent figure. But Lilith refused to have sex underneath Adam. She wanted to have sex on top. And of course,
that
the
is
Jewish
awesome.
Patriarchs did not enjoy this notion that a woman could be on top and could be in the dominant position. So Lilith wasn't welcome in the Bible at all. And then she was twisted into a screeching demon that strangles babies. That was how Lilith was vilified, because she was disobedient to Adam.
They ruined everything.
Yeah.
I think it's it see, I didn't know that about the original story, you know, and how it was twisted around. I think that is fascinating, and it's very I think topical to kind of what's going on, especially over here in the States, this kind of empowerment to women, you know, with the whole Me Too movement, and mm-hmm. they're not ashamed to come out, and which I think is awesome. I'm all for that, and I think that stories like that, it's kind of good to hear nowadays. You know, it's almost like kind of a morale boost, because this has happened before. You know, there was a time where they actually did push down and you know, take away rights. And yeah, my mind's going about 900 miles an hour. It's weird to me that we were able to go originally from a time where we exalted women, thinking that they brought man to the world. They gave birth to the earth, and then somehow we lose that, and we make it so that they can't vote. And it's only been, you know, less than a century ago that they were able to actually vote on their political leaders. Like, how do we go from that extreme to this mm-hmm. extreme? And mm-hmm. there's one defining, I think, answer to that that I'm not even going to ask, because it's the elephant in the room. When the stronghold of religion gets involved.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, it was about 6,000 BC. So the goddess religions prevailed in the Middle East and the Near East. And Then there was an invasion from Indo-European tribes from Georgia in Russia, the Caucasus mountain range. And they were warriors. They were warlike people, and they had warlike gods. So these Indo-European tribes invaded, and they settled wherever they invaded and gradually introduced their gods, which were male and warlike, and gradually ousted the feminine or the goddess-based religions. That's how it happened. And that, and the Jews were part of the Indo-European tribes. So they had that male warrior god as part of their background teaching.
And imagine we could have all probably got along if we'd have just left things alone. There wouldn't be such a divide.
It's just interesting to me because so at one point there was a matriarchy that we worship the goddess, and then that was changed around and we had to worship a male god. And now I believe that we're coming into a time of partnership and reconciliation, and the Me Too movement is all part of that. It's all about making stuff conscious that's been unconscious, that's been in denial for all these years, been kept down and suppressed because God forbid that we would topple the male god. God forbid that we would take power away from the men. So, but the feminine is rising, and that's the kind of the evidence of it for me. The Me Too movement is the evidence that the goddess is coming back, but not to have another matriarchy. I believe this is our evolutionary path, that it's time for masculine and feminine to be reconciled and work together in partnership.
Why is it so controversial, you think? You know, because the feminist movement is one that it seems to strike sort of a controversy with different sects of, especially on the internet, like with the whole YouTube community. I mean, there are hour-long discussions that go on about feminism. Is it beneficial? Is it not? Why the just controversy over that issue of making everybody equal? Why do you think that's fought so hard against?
Well, Kyle, before you ask that, kind of determine what you mean by feminism, because you're describing egalitarianism more than feminism. And that's one of the problems on YouTube, is that the word feminism means different things to different people. Like, I am not considering myself a feminist because I don't like the fourth wave feminism, or even the third wave feminism. But the second wave, I think everybody, I don't know anybody that fights against second wave feminism, of course. And that's more of egalitarianism. So when you're using the word feminism, what are you meaning by it? Because that's one of the big things on YouTube, is that people use that term to mean different things.
Sure. I think that, I mean, my definition of feminism is, I guess I'm just a regular individual when I think about this, but I don't think of them in waves or sex or different levels. It's just feminism to me. I think that if you're a feminist, if you believe that women deserve to be paid equally, treated equally, not deal with sexual harassment, not feel like they're objects, if you can see them as you do your male counterparts, if you're in that, if you're in a marriage that you don't expect them to cook and clean and iron and do all those little things. I think you're a feminist if you see them as equal. And I don't think that there has to be complicated levels to or waves or whatever it is. And I think that's where people get into the big arguments, is because they try to sect it off. But really, it's as simple as, if you believe that women are as equal as men, I think you're a feminist. Now, would that be wrong, Stephanie? Or
no, I'm with you on that. I also honestly don't know a whole lot about the different waves of feminism.
Me either.
I know when I was a feminist, when I was a militant feminist, with my shaved head and my no bra.
Rebel. Radical. Under that definition, I, of course, would obviously be a feminist under those definitions. That's the classical approach to feminism. And I think that most people, unless you're some kind of patriarchal idiot or some kind of misogynist or something like that, fall under that. I think that everybody would agree those are things that we all should have in society. But what happens is you have these extreme people, these really out there third and fourth wave feminists that people don't want to associate with. And so they don't want to take upon that label of feminism, because then people might think that they're associating with those types of radical feminism rather than the
ones that Kyle just.
Well, but that's YouTube. that's the things that's going on YouTube. And that's there's something to be said about it. I mean, people don't want to affiliate with some radical groups. But if you're just talking about everything you said, reproductive rights and legal rights and equality, equal pay, that's all falls under the second wave feminism from about the 60s to the 80s. And of course, again, I don't know anybody that would ever actively say those things are wrong. Who would fight against that kind of stuff unless you're just a dick? I mean, I've seen a couple people. Those are the people that I just think are radicals in themselves, right? Because if you don't think that women and men are equal, there's just something wrong with you. I don't even know what to say to something like that, because obviously there are differences, but equality across the board as far as how we interact with society, men and women are equal in those regards.
You know, it's interesting to hear you speak, Steve, because you say that you can't understand people who would think that way, that women are less than, and yet that's what the Bible tells us to think. That's the whole part of the Adam and Eve story, that women are subservient to their husband and they have to please him whether he's good to them or not. And unless someone's really examined their deeply conditioned beliefs and religious background, there's not a lot of hope as far as I'm concerned. You really have to come to grips with, not you, sorry, a person really has to come to grips with, okay, this is what I've been taught. Is it true? And if it's not something that's loving for me and loving for everybody else, or good for me and good for everybody else, it's probably not true. But it takes courage to throw off those old belief systems and habits of thinking. So I have compassion, really. I have compassion for people who might be judged as limited or narrow or stupid. It's just that they have not yet had the courage to examine their beliefs. And they may never have the courage in this lifetime. Do I want to fight them? No, I'm not interested. It's a waste of energy. Yeah. Let them evolve in their own sweet way, you know. Yeah, just I don't want to go near them.
There's definitely a lot of rationalization when it comes to the Bible, as far as what you said. Obviously, in the Bible, women's rights were not a big thing. Slavery was a thing. It was not indentured servitude. It was a literal form of slavery. The slaves were treated less than human. I've had people try to argue against that. However, what I read into the Bible, they were property. They were chattel. And so when you're, you know, it's funny you mentioned like the earlier story of the of Lilith and stuff like that, because that was one of the original stories. Lilith did not want to be put down under Adam. She wanted to be equal, and so she actually cheated on him with this archangel Samuel, and those offsprings later became in the canon demons. So all the demons are supposedly like from Supernatural. Oh, great show if you haven't watched it. I guess those are all the combination of Lilith and Samuel. I don't know if that's the narrative on that show or not, but that's where that story came from, is that Lilith did not want to be subservient to Adam, and therefore she cheated on him with an archangel, and then their offsprings were demons. Interesting story on that, though.
Very interesting.
Yeah, you see how much women have been vilified. And how, Lilith wanted to have sex on top, and that wasn't acceptable. And
can't
suddenly
have that,
she's
can
the
we?
Mother of demons. I mean, she's not just a woman who has a choice or a preference. She's the mother of demons now.
Yeah,
right.
She was vilified after that. Yeah.
Today, I think men would probably beg for that to be the case.
I'm not going to argue. Yeah.
Here's another good segue, I guess. This is probably the most controversial question that I have to be honest with you, Stephanie. When I read this question, I said, oh, I cannot wait to hear her answer to this. And even as somebody who is now a complete atheist, like I don't believe that that gods exist or any of the stories in the Bible. But even this question kind of made me go, there's somebody that actually will answer this, because it's a brave question. Was Mary, the mother of Jesus, actually a virgin?
No, she was not.
You heard it here. And I don't know why. I don't know why that's so, even now. And again, I think it goes back to that switch that they plant in you that, well, don't wander too far off the path, because even reading that question and me being, you know, totally loud and proud that I don't believe a God exists, there were voices in my head going, ooh, that's going to be a difficult question, you know? But what's the reaction that you get when you answer that? And do you get any kind of backlash? Because I'm sure that brings some heat your way. It's got to.
Pretty much up till now, I've been speaking to the converted. I've been speaking in my own church to people who know that I have unusual ideas and interpret religious scriptures in my particular way. But you know what's interesting for me? When I started doing my talks on God and sex at my church, it was this time last year. It took me all this time, hey, to get brave enough to give a talk on sex in church.
I still can't believe you're that brave. I mean, hats off to you. I mean, that's brave. I can imagine the faces looking out into the sea of.
But then the next time when I started doing my talks on God and sex in church, the third talk was about Mary not being a virgin. And it was at that talk that I was invited to speak at the conference where you saw the video of me speaking at the conference.
Oh, okay.
So after I did the striptease on stage, I kind of warmed the audience up.
Yes, you did. We will link the video too for that so that they can check that out.
Okay. And I think people were having such an amazing time. I was told they were not looking at their cell phones while I was on the stage, which is the biggest compliment any speaker can have today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what you call an icebreaker, I think. Definitely.
People have said to me, that was really interesting. But you know what? Someone explained to me afterwards that most of the people in the audience that day, there were about 4,000 people when I did that talk at the conference. Mm-hmm. Probably about 95% black people, 5% white people. And of that 95% black people, maybe about 40 to 50% pastors from Christian background.
Ooh.
Because the convener of the conference was originally a pastor in the traditional Christian church. So they were surprised and delighted and found it refreshing and totally terrifying. And then a friend of mine who's a bishop who's moved out of the traditional teaching but understands how people think, he said, do you realize, Stephanie, if they actually took on what you're saying, they would be out of a job. If they took it on, really, then they could not any longer get up in the pulpit with any integrity and continue to preach the word that is totally misogynist and not true.
That's fascinating to me, because I think that while you were sitting here talking, I was thinking, I think because you can hear it on the video, you can hear the response to what you're saying. And you make, if you're somebody that is well-grounded in the faith, you make some pretty controversial statements. And the reaction, I think, to me, I interpret it as everybody going, wow, finally somebody saying what we're all thinking. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like a collective sigh. Like, the laughter is like, we've been thinking this the same thing the entire time, but nobody wants to say it out loud. And then here you come up in a robe, do your striptease, and then hit them with Mary was not a virgin. So I think it was, you know, if you can, but it's almost like a, and then I wonder why do people stay with it if that's the reaction? Because if you had firm beliefs in those being actual true stories, it seems like there would be outrage, you know, that you would have people getting up and leaving and protest. But instead, they're all about it. I mean, they're laughing and clapping. And I think that's really telling in the real story. You know what I mean? Did you feel that when you were up there? Because that had to be kind of nerve-wracking for you, especially.
Well, more nerve-wracking because my mother was in the audience.
Oh, man. you just lined it up for yourself on that performance. That's like that's every public speaker's worst nightmare. There, you can do anything now, Stephanie. If you can get through that speech, you can do anything.
I think so. Yeah. No, but I started my talk. My icebreaker was, you know, I've spent years of researching my topic on my knees to God. And I spent years of researching my topic on my knees, but not to God.
What I tell you, Steve, I told Steve that line, that was my favorite line that you used.
I get it. I get it. You're not a Jesus mythicist, obviously, then, right? Because we just had Richard Carrier on, and obviously he promotes Jesus mythicism, that Jesus was not an actual person, but a type of a hero class character that has been evolved over the ages. Now, you actually believe that he did exist, but Mary was not a virgin?
That's an interesting question.
Thank you for that. it's both.
I'm here
and.
For a reason.
Yeah, no, your questions are fab. Both and. So some people believe Jesus was entirely a mythological character. I can go with that. And some people believe that he actually existed, and I can go with that too. I'm not that bothered, honestly. Maybe I should be, but I'm not.
So it doesn't
I'm
matter either
much
way.
More interested in the teaching that came through him.
I agree.
You know, there's actually a group out there called Christian Atheists. They're a sect of Christianity, but they're actual atheists. But a lot of the Christians don't like that term. They don't think that if you believe that Christ existed, obviously that doesn't make you a Christian. But if you follow his teachings and that he believed there's divine, that's what the crux of Christianity is. But there is a group out there that just likes Christ's teachings, and they think he was a person. They like what he had to say, but they don't take him from a divine standpoint, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. So, Stephanie, let's talk about your book. Give us the inspiration for, number one, the title. I think will jump out at people. And, of course, we will include links to where they can read this book as well. But kind of give us the title, first of all. I think it's important. But why you chose that title and what inspired you to kind of put your thoughts to paper.
Okay, thank you for asking that. So the title is The Misadventures of an Irreverent Reverend, and the subtitle is A Spirited Guide for Rebels and Renegades. And Misadventures is M-I-S-S, because I never did the marriage thing, so I'm a miss.
It's a perfect title, by the way.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah,
it's a long title, but it's worth it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And on the front cover, you can see me on the day of my graduation, hoiking up my ministerial robe so that you can see my stocking tops, which I think a lot of people enjoy.
When I saw the front cover with the title and the pose and everything, I knew that I was going to love you instantly. I was like, oh, she's going to be fabulous. We've got together.
So I needn't have worried then. Okay.
No, absolutely not. I think it's awesome.
So what I wanted to do was I wanted to talk about my journey, my spiritual journey. And when I started ministerial school, I had a surprising pre-knowledge of the Bible. And I don't know where that came from, because I didn't grow up in a religious environment, as I told you. So, and I loved metaphysical Bible interpretation. It meant a lot to me to hear the Bible interpreted from a metaphysical standpoint rather than a literal standpoint. So in my book, I've started each chapter with a metaphysical Bible verse, and then a Bible verse, and then my metaphysical interpretation of that, and then a story from my life to illustrate that metaphysical interpretation. I think one of my gifts in this world is to help people see how their thoughts influence their reality and how their life. That life, to me, life is a magnificent orchestrated journey. So all through the book, I write about the miracles that have happened along the way, the synchronicities, the people that I've met that have come, we say the word out of the blue, but there's nothing happens out of the blue. Everything for me is pre-orchestrated. So And I talk about my life as a human being, because I think people have a very, unfortunately, a very warped picture of ministers. They think that they're holy people, that they never have a sexual thought, never have a lustful thought, never have a sinful thought, never do anything wrong, never have a history before they become ministers. And I had a hell of a, well, a her story, actually, not a history. I had a her story where I was...
There we go.
Drinking and experimenting and lots of boyfriends and just not what you think of when you think of a minister, typically. But that was my experience. And I don't regret one part of it at all. And I believe that it made me a much better minister than I could have been if I'd lived a pure, restricted, conservative life. Because I wouldn't have been able to understand people or have compassion for them. So the journey was important. The journey before actually graduating through ministerial school and starting a church, that was all part of the spirit, my spiritual journey, my spiritual growth and evolution. And it had to be that way. And I had to go to the depths and I had to experience what I experienced, which I know most people probably on earth will not experience some of the things I've gone through. And I didn't even put half of them in the book because I couldn't. The book would have gone on forever.
Well, except for the boyfriends, it sounds like my college days.
Well, my college days.
didn't have any boyfriends. I had quite a few girlfriends, but yeah, I definitely can relate to you. Yeah, I was going to say it's much more like, sounds like Kyle's experiencing school.
To me, I think that number one, I think that there are people that are going to be listening to this giving you a standing ovation during that last bit. I think that it's refreshing to hear from somebody who's an atheist. I don't like the idea of religion per se. I think that in most cases it's harmful and it pushes people backwards. But something like this, I could completely get behind because it doesn't highlight the faults in you or why you're wrong or what you need to fix. It highlights the best parts of you. It teaches you to kind of push to be a better you and says that the you that you're now is okay. You know, that's one of the things that I struggled with growing up, obviously, being in the South and gay and hearing all the time that you're an abomination and that you're going to burn. And it affects you. I think that it's easy for people in the faith to just say, oh, it's just what God says or whatever. But if you're actually on the other end of that, if you're the person being told you're that, it scars you on a level. Mm-hmm. And I'm thankful that I was able to, you know, bounce back out of that because I was lucky. Some people aren't like that. And I think that's kind of my axe to grind, if you will, now is I want to come out against that teaching and to tell people, especially that we're in my, you know, circumstances, that you are okay and that you are beautiful and that nothing's wrong with you. And I think that even though I'm an atheist, this is a type of spirituality that I would be 110% all about. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want a minister unless they had gone through the stuff that most people, I think, do go through. So it's very refreshing, I think, to hear something that's different to me, but I can see totally embracing.
That's lovely to hear. Thank you. I was so looking forward to this conversation. I've been listening a lot to, I listened to your previous episodes, and I came across Seth Andrews recently, who spoke also, I think it was mm-hmm. last month. Mm-hmm. And I'm just loving listening to people speak about atheism. It fits perfectly with what I believe.
Are you considered a theist, though? Even though it's more of a spiritual religious movement, do you consider yourself a theist, or do you consider yourself more of an atheist, or does it really matter?
I'm a spiritual being on a spiritual journey, and that's the best I can do. Other labels, they're not that interesting to me. They're just concepts, and I'm trying to get free of concepts because I think concepts restrict me. They don't free me.
Good point. That's a very that hit kind of home. You know, we spend so much time, I think, I think you could go back probably through this episode and count how many times I've said I'm an atheist. But when you hear somebody else say, you know, maybe in the grand scheme of things, that doesn't really matter. You might be right there.
And Kyle, you know, we found out who the one person was who watched that episode. Just kidding. That was actually one of our more popular episodes, and I'm glad that you've actually listened to it. We enjoyed talking to Seth immensely. He was such a pleasant person to speak with. He's just a very calm demeanor, articulate, funny. Yeah. He had great stories, so we really enjoyed that conversation with him as well. I'm glad that you liked listening to it.
I think it's important that I think people like yourself and Seth, people of that kind of more inclusive ilk, can kind of spin that whole narrative that if you don't believe in God, then you're morally bankrupt or that you don't have morals. I think that's a horrible stereotype that gets put on. And anybody that listened to you tonight or that went back and listened to Seth, there's no way you can say that and be honest. I mean, there's no way you can say that and genuinely be an honest person. It's just not going to happen. So I think what you're doing is beautiful, and I just think it's wonderful. And this was on a level, I knew it was going to be good, but this was just so much more, because I think that you're always learning. I learn something new every day, and I probably learned 20 different things in this past hour and a half conversation.
Oh, I'm very flattered. Thank you. How lovely that you would say that. Thank you.
Well, it's true.
And I learned a lot too. Just really enjoying this rap. Thank you.
Well, I know it's late where you are, and I hated to keep you up, but I'm so glad that you decided to stick it through and come on to these two cranky fellas from the States.
I'm not that cranky. Just love
you. Are
when I haven't had my coffee. Oh yeah, then yeah, I'm cranky.
Stephanie, would you be interested in coming back on sometime and going through some of the questions that I had? I'll have you know that I got to two of them out of 19.
I would love to have her back. I would love to be able to ask more questions. And on a, probably a better time for her, though. I think it's like 1 o'clock in the morning for her probably now.
Yeah.
1:30. So yeah. We do appreciate you spending your evening with us, or early morning as it is in your case. So
no, I've loved it. And I'm just preparing for the interview. I've been doing a lot of reading and researching as well. I'm currently writing my third book, and it's called The Irreverent Reverend Rides Again.
Yes, I'm writing that down.
We will definitely put all those links in the video description when the video is posted.
Oh, we need to do that real quick. Stephanie, if you would go through and tell people where they can find out more about your ministry, where they can find your books, and however else they can connect with whatever platforms that you have. I know you have a blog and social media, so kind of put that out there so people can find you, and we'll link to it as well.
Okay, so the book title again is The Misadventures of an Irreverent Reverend, A Spirited Guide for Rebels and Renegades, and that's on Amazon, Kindle, and paperback. And my website is timelesstransitions.net, www.timelesstransitions.net. My blog is similar to my Misadventures book. I talk about miracles and synchronicities and the way that a thought becomes a reality. So that's what I'm interested in. And it's called Miracles, Mysteries, and Metaphysical Musings. So the link is Miracles and Mysteries at WordPress.com. And what else? That's it. Oh, Facebook. My Facebook fan page is Reverend Stephanie Clark.
Do you have a Twitter?
I don't do Twitter. I don't tweet.
No Twittering. She's not a tweeter.
No. I should say not yet. I haven't... I'm still a virgin with that stuff. So.
Oh, well said. Well, Reverend, however reverend it was a absolute pleasure to have you in the Church of Non Sequitur, because I feel like that's exactly where we went tonight. And I haven't been there in years. So congratulations. You did something that I didn't think would ever be done again.
Uh-huh. Okay. How wonderful. Thank you for being so open.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you, guys. Good night.
Good night.
Goddess bless.